Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly's. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
But when Cromwell arrives, he's facing a very different type of war. I think he expected to be fighting big battles out in the field. What he actually ends up fighting is a number of isolated sieges as the Confederate Royalist Alliance retreats back into their strongholds and waits for Cromwell to attack them.
And attack them he did. In the coming months, Cromwell's massive war machine would roll across Ireland, leaving not just walls, countless lives shattered in its wake. In August 1649, Oliver Cromwell's conquering war machine arrived from England near the city of Dublin, Ireland. No storm clouds could have been more ominous. In total, Cromwell brought 12,000 soldiers from his new model army to wage the Irish campaign. They were comprised of roughly 4,000 cavalry and 8,000 infantry. A full two-thirds of Oliver Cromwell's new model army was composed of musketeers like this agent. Their primary armament was this weapon, a matchlock. Now, like all muzzle-loading weapons, you put powder and ball in here, ram it home. But there was a difference. This weapon required you to carry a burning match or fuse throughout the course of the battle, difficult in and of itself. To fire it, to launch all of that powder and get the round down range, you were required to prime the pan by placing a small amount of powder in that pan. Close the pan. Then load your match into this device, which is called a serpent or the lock, hence matchlock. Imagine all of this while the enemy is charging at you. Now, the matchlock was so long and cumbersome that musketeers frequently had to use an aiming or support stick like this one in order to get any sort of accuracy at all with the weapon. Now, you take a look, got a target. Open the pan, aim down range, and hope for the best.
Someone cynically suggested probably about as many people were killed by being hit over the head with the barrel of a musket than were actually killed by the bullets that muskets fired.
The remaining third of Cromwell's new model army was composed of pikemen. Now, these were generally tall and beefy guys, and the reason is they had to handle something like this, an 18-foot spear or pike. They often cut it down in combat so that it'd be more handy in close quarters. Now, pikemen were generally employed in the middle of an infantry formation, and their primary job was to form a screen for those musketeers against cavalry attack. For that reason, they wore armor and a helmet, like this, called a pot then and now. The idea was that that armor would provide protection against musket balls and sword strikes.
Cromwell's battle plan in Ireland called for securing the ports along the eastern and southeastern coastline. Once secure, he could move inland toward the capital of the resistance movement located at Kilkenny. For his opening attack, Cromwell decided to take out the royalist stronghold at Drogheda, 25 miles north of Dublin. Taking this strategically located town would help to secure Dublin and Cromwell's northern flank. Drogheda was well defended. The town was encircled by a wall 20 feet high and 6 feet thick at its base. To defend Drogheda, there were 300 cavalry and more than 2,000 infantry. To open the attack on Drogheda, Cromwell placed his batteries south of town, one to the east of St. Mary's Church, the other on this high ground that today is known as Cromwell's Mount. It took 2 weeks for Cromwell to set up the enormous gun batteries, the largest of which, the cannon of 8, fired a shot weighing more than 60 pounds.
There are very few modern defences in the 17th century in Ireland at this time. Many of the towns and cities, and Drogheda would have been a perfect example of this, have simple medieval curtain walls. They're very high, but they're not that deep. And what they're actually designed to defend against are people who are trying to scale the walls, be it through ladders or whatever way, trying to get over the walls. What they're not built to defend against is artillery.
And fire!
As Cromwell's artillery opened on Drogheda's medieval walls, his regimental commanders prepared for the storm.
Yeah!
In a military tradition of the day, they drew lots to see which regiments would lead the charge. The unlucky winners were known as the Forlorn Hope.
His plan was to open 2 breaches in Drogheda's walls. Now, breaches tend to funnel an attacker into killing zones. Multiple breaches, or 2 entry points, force the defender to divide his effort, and they give the attacking force more opportunity to exploit the breach.
By early evening, 11 September 1649, Cromwell's cannons had opened 2 breaches in the castle wall. Then Cromwell gave the order to charge.
Lay hands on myself, lay down, lay down!
Amid hymn singing and war cries, the Forlorn Hope surged toward the wall.
If you had been a soldier assaulting the breach in the wall at Drogheda, it would have been absolutely terrifying. As terrifying if you'd been, say, a GI landing on D-Day. Low. Chances of surviving were very low. You knew that.
Brutal, bloody, and nasty warfare. Because those at the back can see what's going to happen to them. Those in the middle are stuck and can't do anything about it. Those at the front are fighting for their lives.
You had to climb over not just walls which had fallen down and stones, but dead bodies all over the place to get through this narrow gap.
Cromwell watched from the rear, furious as the first assault was repulsed. When a second assault failed to penetrate the town, he'd seen enough.
Cromwell, after seeing that his men were now wavering, led the third assault himself, right into the breach in the wall.
He put his money where his mouth was, you might say. He wasn't an officer who hung back and told other people to go take the risks.
Cromwell threw most of his reserve, some 8,000 troops, at the breach. As corpses piled up at the wall, Cromwell became filled with rage.
The restraints which he has in everyday life, as everybody does, seem to disappear, and he becomes almost mad with battle.
Cromwell's anger fueled his men, and now it was fueling him. At last, his soldiers successfully swarmed through the town, and he let his tightly disciplined force off the leash.
There was a long tradition that if you survived the breach, you are allowed to plunder, to rape, to loot, to kill, to murder the enemy and civilians on the other side. Now that tradition had a purpose, because what you were saying to the defenders is, if we have to go through that breach, if we have to take terrible casualties, you are going to pay a price, and a terrible price. If you surrender now, we'll let everyone march out. You can take your women and children. But if you make us go through that breach, we are going to get our revenge.
In the hours that followed, Cromwell's troops carried out a massacre here within the walls of Drogheda. It's been the subject of controversy ever since.
Many of the town's defenders were killed right here on Mill Mount, where they'd retreated. Some parliamentary officers offered quarter, but Cromwell himself rode up and said, "Take no prisoners."
In most circumstances, the honorable way of dealing with them would be to take them prisoner. But Cromwell chose the harsh line here, though some would say he was, as I say, within the accepted rules of war at the time.
Around 100 Irish soldiers retreated to the steeple and roofs of St. Peter's Church. Cromwell personally ordered the pews to be piled like firewood and set aflame. The Irish soldiers were burned alive. In total, somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 people died within the walls of Drogheda.
There's no doubt that what happened was a massacre. Cromwell lost control. He lost control of himself and of his army, which, at the end of the day, is not what a general's supposed to do.
Cromwell can certainly be faulted for succumbing to the bloodlust of the moment and losing his self-control, but he also thought the shock and awe of Drogheda might shorten the war by showing the Irish that resistance was futile. They've been called the kings of battle and the dogs of war. Something you never forget if you've been to war is the frightening sound of the artillery as they blast out their deadly cannonade. For most of the Irish people, Oliver Cromwell's assault in 1649 would have been their first exposure to big guns.
There wasn't much noise in the 17th century. There were no boom boxes. There was no ubiquitous television. And therefore, when you have the noise of artillery going off, it must have sounded terrifying.
Artillery was critical to Cromwell's success in Ireland, but it also presented logistical problems. With each gun weighing several tons, moving artillery from battle to battle could be a major drag on the pace of a conquering army. Taking this into account, Cromwell wisely decided to move his artillery train by ship when he deployed his army south from Drogheda to his next target, Wexford. Wexford was a walled town located within a harbor at the mouth of the River Slaney. Entry to the harbor was guarded by Rosslare Fort, which Cromwell's cavalry commander took with little resistance. To the southeast of town, on high ground just outside the walls, stood Wexford Castle. By the time Cromwell's army arrived at Wexford's walls, the Irish weather had whipped up a cold, windy storm, turning his encampment into a quagmire and preventing his guns from being offloaded in the harbor. With winter fast approaching, Wexford would make ideal quarters for his ailing troops. So Cromwell would need a repeat of Drogheda, a swift campaign using artillery to breach the walls and a fierce assault to seize the town.
By now, of course, the inhabitants of Wexford have heard about Drogheda and don't want to have that experience.
The governor of the town was under pressure from the townspeople to surrender, but he was waiting to see if the royalist general Ormond would deliver reinforcements. The governor tried to stall Cromwell through negotiation.
But Cromwell preferred to let his artillery do the talking. When the weather allowed, He began to offload his big guns and emplace them here on this piece of high ground south of town, known today as Treespan Rock. His first target, Wexford Castle.
On the same day, Ormond arrived with reinforcements. Ormond himself stayed outside the town to watch the proceedings from the north bank of the river. His heart must have sunk as Cromwell's gunners opened up with 8 cannons and 2 mortars, firing 100 shots in all.
Unlike traditional cannon, which fired a solid shot at a relatively flat trajectory, mortars, like this one, fired a hollow shot at a relatively high trajectory. The idea was to lob a projectile beyond enemy fortifications or into the center of an enemy formation. Now, this is a relatively small mortar, but Cromwell's gunners had mortars like this that could fire projectiles of up to 500 pounds, and they fired several types of shells. Some were for use against fortifications, some were anti-personnel. Now, the shell that a mortar fires is not solid at all. In fact, it's hollow and filled with gunpowder. It's detonated by a separate fuse, the idea being to make sure that the projectile detonates when it's on the target and not before. Now, Cromwell's gunners took to calling these shells grenados, but the Irish referred to them as bombs, which is the first use of what's now become a relatively common word.
Again, medieval Irish stone proved no match for modern English lead. By noon, several breaches had been made in the castle walls. Once again, the town governor opened negotiations with Cromwell for a ceasefire. While this was happening, the commander in charge of Wexford Castle opened his gates and turned over the keys to Cromwell's men. Chaos ensued. Another rout was on.
This takes place while Cromwell is in negotiations with the leaders of Wexford for the surrender of the town. Cromwell knows nothing of this, and therefore the attack on Wexford takes place, if you like, almost without his knowledge.
This market area is known as the Bull Ring. It was here in 1649 that the defenders of Wexford were slaughtered. There was no stopping the Cromwellian onslaught.
So again, we have the killing not only of the entire garrison, but also of civilians, as happened at Drogheda. His only comment on this after it's taken place, again, is that this is the righteous judgment of God on these barbarous wretches for their behavior during the 1640s.
Cromwell's army left the town too ruined to serve as winter quarters. So they had to march on. It became clear that no Irish army would challenge Cromwell in the field. He'd been forced into siege warfare. Cromwell had little experience with sieges, and his explosive personality was hardly suited to a siege mentality.
He is, in many senses, an exceptional cavalry commander, and in some senses, an exceptional commander. But in terms of that art of siege warfare, he is often bullheaded and irresponsible.
Cromwell's next major target was Waterford. It was Ireland's second largest city at the time and located on the river shore. Cromwell wanted to sail his ships right up to the town and unload his artillery. But to do so, he'd have to pass a formidable fortification at Duncannon, which guarded the mouth of the river. To take Waterford, he'd have to attack that fort.
Unlike the medieval walls at Drogheda and Wexford, Duncannon was one of Ireland's first modern fortifications. It was built in 1588 to defend against the Spanish Armada.
Its angled walls provided a much better defense against incoming artillery shells than traditional flat walls. It also gave the defenders a better platform for firing their cannons against a besieging force. Even if Cromwell's men somehow survived the artillery fire, fire and made it through the outer walls of the fort, they still had to contend with a deep, dry moat, which would surely turn into a graveyard for them. Further complicating Cromwell's plans, there was no safe port near Duncannon to land and unload his heavy siege cannons. That left him with only his small field guns for the siege.
On fire!
Cromwell's small guns were no match for the angled walls of Duncannon. True to its design, the fort could not be penetrated.
At that point, Cromwell's tactical ineptness as a siege commander starts to come into play. This tactical bullishness is, when met with resistance, not the only way forward, and he can't think of another solution. That's all he's got in his locker, as it were.
Unable to make any progress, a frustrated Cromwell was forced to call off the siege of Duncannon. Cromwell's prospects of taking Waterford were now in question. The mark of a great general is his ability to innovate, adapt, and overcome. If Oliver Cromwell still hoped to conquer Ireland, he'd have to do just that. In November of 1649, Oliver Cromwell was very much a man in trouble. He'd come to Ireland in search of one large, decisive battle. The enemy wouldn't give it to him. What was supposed to be a quick conquering campaign was dragging on. Through attrition, his 12,000-man field army had been reduced to only 3,000.
He's losing men, not necessarily from combat, but from disease. Ireland is a place in the 17th century that punishes large armies, and small armies can't survive. Dysentery, other diseases sweep through the ranks very early on in the campaign.
Frustrated by his failed effort to capture the fort at Duncannon, Cromwell's plan to seize Waterford by sea had to be completely retooled. Instead of moving troops and supplies up the river from the south, he would have to bring them over land from the north. Only one enemy could stop Cromwell's advance now, and that was the Irish weather. Heavy rains came, which made moving troops difficult and rolling in heavy siege guns nearly impossible. By 2 December 1649, Cromwell realized that a siege of Waterford under these conditions would be unwise.
With that, Cromwell withdrew his forces and gave up his campaign to attack and take Waterford.
The New Model Army retired to winter quarters in garrisons stretching throughout the southwest of Ireland, where Cromwell had been employing politics rather than ballistics to convince a series of towns to surrender. At the same time, members of Parliament were writing to Cromwell with increasingly desperate pleas. The son of King Charles had gone to Scotland, where he planned a renewed offensive to restore the monarchy. With the new British government in danger, Cromwell was asked to come home and save the day.
The pressure on him to go back to England to start to resolve the conflict which is blowing up between England and Scotland is intense at this point.
With this new sense of urgency and a break in the Irish weather, Cromwell delayed his return to England in order to put his war machine back on the march at the end of January. Waterford had proved too difficult to capture, so Cromwell set his sights on Kilkenny, the seat of power for General Ormond and the center of the Irish resistance. Now, Cromwell began the most complicated maneuvering of his Irish campaign. He split his forces into two main columns, forming a huge pincer. With that, Cromwell crushed all resistance in his path and converged around Kilkenny in late March. Victory at Kilkenny would require seizing both the town and Kilkenny Castle, which had the added significance of being General Ormond's home. The castle stood on high ground overlooking the River Nore. A wall connected to the castle spread out to surround the adjacent town. Cromwell's first move was to send a detachment of redcoats to set up a cannon battery outside the south wall. They opened a breach.
Charge!
Cromwell then ordered his infantry to assault. And Cromwell kept up the pressure for several days, sending more infantry assaults into town and blasting a second breach into the walls. On 27 March, the governor of Kilkenny finally surrendered both the town and the castle. While the surrender of Kilkenny was an important victory for Cromwell, the Irish were not yet conquered. A fierce pocket of resistance existed in the nearby town of Clonmel. For his final battle in Ireland, he would attack them. In late April 1650, Oliver Cromwell's rejuvenated army of 8,000 soldiers and 600 cavalry arrived at the walls of Clonmel on the banks of the River Shore. The name Clonmel, it seemed, would now be added to the bloody toll begun at Drogheda 7 months before. But the citizens of Clonmel had reason to take heart. In command of their garrison was Hugh Duff O'Neill, an experienced warrior and resistance leader. He had 2,000 men under his command, mostly Irish Catholic troops from Ulster.
The most disciplined, the most successful, the most experienced troops that the Irish had were these Ulster Irish forces. Hugh Duff is one of the few commanders that seems to be able to take on Cromwell and seems to be confident in taking him on.
Cromwell had little choice about where to place his heavy guns, the biggest of which weighed 8,000 pounds. With a river to the south and marshy terrain to the east and west, the only ground that could support these monsters was to the north. Because of this, Cromwell wouldn't be able to use his favorite tactic of creating two simultaneous breaches. This didn't worry Cromwell, although it should have, since it meant that O'Neill could focus his defense on one killing zone instead of two. It took nearly a day for Cromwell's guns to breach the wall. The plan was to send the infantry in first. Once they were in, they'd swing around and open one of the town's gates for the waiting cavalry. Cromwell ordered the charge and personally joined his cavalry at the gate. He had no idea that O'Neill had prepared a nasty surprise. Now, here's Cromwell's tips for conquerors. Be brutal and violent in your opening attack to instill fear and demoralize your enemy. Outman and outgun your enemy. Use heavy artillery wherever possible. Secure unbreakable supply lines. They are your lifeline. In the spring of 1650, Oliver Cromwell's redcoats began their defiant charge into the town of Clonmel, the latest target on their campaign to conquer Ireland. Intoning hymns and psalms as they charged, they poured through the breach, God's army storming its way to yet another victory. But the Irish commander of the garrison, Hugh O'Neill, had other ideas. He had laid a trap. Behind the city walls, he'd constructed two walls perpendicular to the breach and one parallel to it, forming a pen. Atop the walls, O'Neill placed his artillery and men. Once Cromwell's men charged through the killing zone, the Irish were able to fire down on them like shooting fish in a barrel.
The guys following into the breach didn't know that their colleagues were trapped inside the wall, so they kept on pouring in, pouring in, pouring in.
O'Neill had built the walls of his trap with firing steps, allowing musketeers to fire, then duck down and reload while another man stepped up to discharge his shot. Other musketeers fired down from the windows of surrounding houses. Death came in many ways to Cromwell's soldiers who were caught in O'Neill's trap. Some were stabbed with pikes or slashed with scythes. Others were crushed by timber blocks hurled by an improvised catapult. Still others were mutilated by cannons firing chain shot.
This is what's known as chain shot. It's essentially two cannonballs joined by a length of chain. When this was fired, it would spin through the air and cut a bloody path through an enemy formation. Even if the chain broke, which it often did under the impact of firing, it simply turned the cannon into the ultimate shotgun. It may be that war is hell is the ultimate cliche, but the fighting in the breach at Clonmel sure came close.
When the town gates didn't open quickly, Cromwell sensed that something was going wrong with the assault. He rode over to the breach to see for himself and was furious to see his men retreating from the wall. Cromwell urged his infantry to fight on, but for the first time, his charisma had no effect on his troops. So he ordered his cavalry to dismount and sent them into the breach.
Crossbows, charge! Yeah!
He really just has one tactic, which is to blast the walls and charge in. Now, that works successfully at Drogheda and to some degree at Wexford as well. At Clonmel, it goes disastrously wrong, and Cromwell really doesn't have a plan B.
Fighting continued inside the walls for 3 hours before Cromwell was forced to admit defeat and call off his assault. Somewhere between 1,000 and 2,500 parliamentary soldiers died in that assault, around a tenth of Cromwell's army. Many of his senior officers lay dead.
The resistance that was put up by Hugh Dove O'Neill was very effective and cost Cromwell a great many men and really gave him a bloody nose. I mean, even great generals have bad days at the office. Cromwell was no exception. He didn't bat 1,000, and nobody does.
Surprisingly, the following day, the mayor of Clonmel surrendered the town to Cromwell. But when Cromwell marched through the gates, he discovered that Duff O'Neill had outwitted him again. Low on ammunition and supplies, the cunning Irish commander had moved his force out of town under cover of darkness. In the end, Cromwell had succeeded in taking the town, but the siege of Clonmel remains a blight on his record. After Clonmel, Cromwell finally gave in to the mounting pressure to return to England. He departed Ireland on 26 May 1650, to prepare for war against a royalist invasion force in Scotland. He left the Irish campaign in the hands of his son-in-law, Henry Ireton. Under Ireton's command, the Redcoats were finally able to take the town of Waterford. It took more than 2 years, but town by town, Oliver Cromwell's New Model Army eventually conquered the entire Emerald Isle. Military victory didn't spell the end of Cromwell's intervention in Ireland. After the war ended, he set in motion what became known as the Cromwellian Settlement. It was a plan that saw the land of 3,000 Catholics seized and turned over to English Protestants.
This left a legacy of bitterness for hundreds of years. That bitterness and dispossession has made it impossible to establish good relations between Ireland and England, and that legacy is with us, at least to a degree, to this day.
After conquering the Irish and defeating the Scots, Cromwell put away his sword and went back to politics. In 1653, he dissolved Parliament and took personal control of Britain as its Lord Protector. After his death in 1658, the monarchy was quickly restored, and public sentiment turned so against Cromwell that his body was exhumed, hanged for public display, and then beheaded. To the Irish, that must have seemed like ultimate justice. I'm Captain Dale Dye. Thanks for watching Conquerors.
Peace to the YouTube community out there. It's your boy, Ishmael Allah. coming at you again. Just wanted to respond back. I had got an email sent to me. A sister had asked a question if I knew anything about white slavery. And I do, and I'll be happy to share the information with you. I'll give you a brief overview kind of about white slavery, what I do know about it. I took a couple notes, and I also wanted to share with you a couple of books. I got a nice library here at the crib. Two books that I would probably recommend for you to get for a good foundation of white slavery is They Were White and They Were Slaves. It's by Michael Hoffman. It's a decent book. As well as White Cargo. This is by two authors, Don Jordan and Michael Walsh. So again, White Cargo and They Were White and They Were Slaves. Two books. There are other books that are out there, but I'll share with you what I do know about it. White slavery has been in America. There have been white slaves in America for over 100 years. I'm talking about the hidden history of white people not knowing that they were slaves. This happened for over 100 years. There's a professor at Yale, David Brian Davis is his name. And the quote that's coming from David Brian Davis, October 11th, 1990, is that as early as the 14th to the 15th century, white slaves were shipped to multiple countries. It was labeled as like a booming slave trade during that time on the markets in the Black Sea coast, into Italy, Spain, Egypt, and the Mediterranean islands, as well as Barbados to Virginia. I'm going to focus right now, particularly on, since we're dealing with America, the Barbados to Virginia connection. Again, that's the 14th to the 15th century of white slaves being used. Barbados, during that time, would literally beat their white slaves to death. I think you probably need a good synopsis or picture of exactly what was going on, where these slaves were coming from. I'm sure if you have any basic history about it, you would know that the slaves came from England. A good idea of kind of like the way to see what that life was like is to study Oliver Twist. That's a good movie for y'all to check out. It'll explain to you that the English slums of the 17th, the 18th, and the 19th century, they were considered the pits of white suffering. Maggots all in the trash, they were eating scraps, they were cold, wearing rags for clothing, very, very poor condition. So definitely check that out. And also during Oliver Twist times, they would like have the children and they would, you know, have them as chimney sweeps, and they were called human brooms, because they would go down, you know, take a little, you know, 6-7 year old kid, shoot them down there to clean out the chimneys and stuff. So they were, you know, doing the child labor stuff. But it was a very, 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 very poor country at that particular time. England historian William William Inglis, he stated in 1836 that the starving agricultural laborers of southern England are worse off than the American Negroes. So again, the condition was very, very bad over in England. That was even in the 1800s that they were worse off than the American Negro. That was by an eyewitness. And America was, it was considered England's dumping ground. England was later, they replaced America later on with Australia. That's the foundation of how Australia was found by the English. It was the dumping ground of their prisoners, of their underclass, of their totally unwanted. First it was America, then it was Australia. In one of my previous tapes, I stated that I had went to Sydney, Australia. And if you go to Sydney, Australia, it's definitely a place that you should try to go in your lifetime. There's an area in Australia called the Rock District. And if you go down to the Rock, right now it's like a bunch of like bars and, you know, it's kind of a trendy area. But it's actually, it was like a slaving post. It's where a lot of the white slaves that went to when they originally sent to Australia. Again, that's called the Rock District in Australia. So anyways, again, this book right here, this is a good book because it kind of gives it to you a little bit raw. Michael Hoffman, he's actually from this area. He's from like upstate New York. I guess it's outside of New York City, upstate New York, maybe central New York type of area. I'm going to try to track him down, see if I can get him on the phone. If y'all really want to do a follow-up with him, I can see if I can get him on the phone or something. Maybe we can build a little bit. But you got to be careful with this book right here because he's giving it to you raw, the way that it comes. But also, you got to be careful because he be throwing little darts in there, you know what I mean? He kind of, in order to boost up what white people was going through, of slavery, he kind of using the expense of black people kind of minimizing what we did as well. So it's kind of a give and take here. He's going to give it to you raw, so it's definitely a good book, but make sure you check it out. The reason why I want you to check out is, for instance, on page 41, he states that he's talking about Frederick Douglass and his quote about the 4th of July is yours, not mine. And then the way that he puts it, he got that little, what I'm talking about. Kind of got that bite to it, you know what I mean? So Frederick Douglass was a freedom fighter, you know what I mean, his whole life. So, you know what I mean, I don't appreciate somebody trying to minimize what Frederick Douglass was about. But also he states in here that a few blacks fought on the side of the Americans during the Revolution. That's a lie. It was quite a few blacks that fought on the side, including some Massachusetts Negroes known as the Bucks of America. That part is true. The claim has long been made that the first victim of the British and American Revolution was a black, Crispus Attucks. In fact, Attucks was an Indian. And he stops. Now see, Hoffman right there is taking a dart at what Crispus Attucks was all about, because Crispus Attucks was black. You dig? And what he's trying to do is, in order to boost themselves up and him explaining their white suffering, because they did suffer quite a bit, he's lowering what we did. Let me give you the facts about Crispus Attucks, and then we can go ahead and we can build on that. Now, Crispus Attucks, in 1723, Crispus Attucks was born in slavery in Framingham, Massachusetts. His father, Prince, was captured in Africa. So Crispus Attucks' father was captured in Africa. That means that he's black. So don't try that, man. You know what I mean? You coming sideways and how you trying to come at us, you know what I mean? And like I said, you try to boost yourself up, but you're trying to, you see where that's going, right? All right, so his father was black and captured in Africa.
Straight up, the Irish were never slaves.
Emerald Isle of the Caribbean and home of a unique race of people, the Black Irish.
It was under the press gangie of Cromwell that hundreds of people from Cork, Kilkenny and Drogheda were expelled to the West Indies. They would have arrived just as the first importations of African slaves took place. So, both cruelly uprooted from their homes, Irish and African Negro shared a common suffering, a common grievance, and for the most part lived together in peace and common understanding. The home of Mr. and Mrs. Allen is also the local post office. Their soft accents are typical of Montserrat and might easily be confused with the lilt in parts of West Cork.
Now, how did the family come to Montserrat, Mr. Allen?
Well, the Irish people came to Montserrat on account of Cromwell, where he was exiled. We heard they had some fighting there, and the Irish people came and it was inside. So they was sent out of the island. So, and we are some of the older descendants.
We have Allen, Daly, Sweeney's, Ryan.
They're all related to you, are they?
They are one relation.
King James II and Charles I also led a continued effort to enslave the Irish. Britain's famed Oliver Cromwell furthered this practice of dehumanizing one's next-door neighbor. The Irish slave trade began when James II sold 30,000 Irish prisoners as slaves to the New World. His proclamation of 1625 required Irish political prisoners to be sent overseas and sold to English settlers in the West Indies. By the mid-1600s, the Irish were the main slaves sold to Antigua and Montserrat.
There's a spot in me heart which no Colleen me own. There's a depth in me soul never sounded unknown. Sure, I love the dear silver that shines in your hair, and the brow that's all furrowed unwrinkled with care. I kiss the dear fingers so toil worn for me. Oh, God bless you and keep you, Mother McCree.
At that time, 70% of the total population of Montserrat were Irish slaves. Ireland quickly became the biggest source of human livestock for English merchants. The majority of the early slaves to the New World were actually white, something many people aren't taught in their school. From 1641 to 1652, over 500,000 Irish were killed by the English, and another 300,000 were sold as slaves. Ireland's population fell from about 1.5 million to 600,000 just in one single decade. Families were ripped apart as the British did not allow Irish fathers to take their wives or children with them across the Atlantic. This led to a helpless population of homeless women and children. Britain's solution was to auction them off as well. During the 1650s, over 100,000 Irish children between the ages of 10 and 14 were taken from their parents and sold as slaves in the West Indies, Virginia, and New England. In this decade, 52,000 Irish, mostly women and children, were sold to Barbados and Virginia. Another 30,000 Irish men and women were also transported and sold to the highest bidder. In 1656, Cromwell ordered that 2,000 Irish children be taken to Jamaica and sold as slaves to English settlers. Many people today will avoid calling the Irish slaves what they truly were, slaves. They'll come up with terms like indentured servants. This is to describe what occurred to the Irish. However, in most cases, from the 17th and 18th centuries, Irish slaves were nothing more than human cattle. As an example, the African slave trade was just beginning during the same period. It is well recorded that African slaves, not tainted with the stain of the hated Catholic theology and more expensive to purchase, were often treated far better than their Irish counterparts. African slaves were very expensive during the late 1600s, as they were 50 sterling. Irish slaves came cheap, no more than 5 sterling. If a planter whipped or branded or beat an Irish slave to death, it was never a crime. A death was nothing more than a monetary setback, but far cheaper than killing a more expensive African. The English masters quickly began breeding the Irish women for both their own personal pleasure and for greater profit. Children of slaves were themselves also slaves, which increased the size of the master's free workforce. Even if an Irish woman somehow obtained her freedom, her kids would remain slaves.
New York had a population of 372,000 people, and approximately 52,000 people of that population was Irish immigrants. However, the worst discrimination the Irish faced was not in New York, but in the highly populated town of Boston, Massachusetts, a largely Anglo-Saxon town with a population of 115,000 people. Many Irish, when they arrived, oftentimes fell victim to unscrupulous landlords, who would oftentimes charge them high prices for a 9-by-11-foot room. A family of 10 might be expected to sleep in such a small, tight living quarter, and sometimes the rooms had no sanitation, ventilation, or even daylight. The overflow of Irish would settle into the gardens, backyards, and alleys surrounding houses living in the wooden shacks. Demand for housing of any quality was extraordinary. People lived in musty cellars with low ceilings that partially flooded with every tide. Old warehouses and other buildings were hastily converted into rooming houses using flimsy wooden partitions that provided no privacy. On top of housing discrimination, many posters and propaganda displayed Irish people as lesser humans, oftentimes with ape-like features implying that they were farther down on the evolutionary scale as opposed to supposed English Puritans or those of English descent. In Boston, rivalry between jobs also created intense discrimination. As an unskilled Irish immigrant, one could make up to a dollar a day, as opposed to the 8 cents that they would receive in Ireland. This, copulated with the growing anti-Catholic and anti-Irish propaganda, created many problems. Many places were reluctant or outright refused to give Irish people jobs. Many places would oftentimes hang "No Irish Need Apply" signs in store windows, creating less and less opportunity for success.
The only jobs they could get were civil service jobs that were dirty, dangerous, or both. Firefighters and police officers, jobs that no one else wanted, the career considered undesirable due to the low pay, few benefits, the poor working conditions. The Irish gladly accepted these careers because it was the way to become a part of a mainstream America, and it was a way to give back to their new country, a country they call home. To be respected in their new home, the deaths of firemen and cops were not uncommon, and when these deaths would occur, the Irish community would howl, including the mournful bagpipes. Over the years, this tradition spread to firefighters and police officers who are not of Irish descent.
Oh!
Gifted a golden throat as any of you cocksuckers being loose from religion are ever likely to hear. What can I say about the Daily Department? I mean, really.
He died young. Too young.
And only 40 years old.
No, had it lived, his dick would have been 134. Shut up. Shut up. It's coming to me. He was the black sheep. The permanent pariah. He asked no quarter of the bosses and none was given. He learned no lessons. He acknowledged no mistakes. He was as stubborn a Mick as ever stumbled out of the Northeast parishes to take a patrolman's shield. He broke no authority. He did what he wanted to do, and he said what he wanted to say, and in the end, he gave you the clearances. He's natural police, as he was. And I don't say that about many people, even when they're here on the felt. I don't give that one up unless it happens to be true. Natural police.
This is a story of the slave trade between Europe and Africa, a tragic tale of coastal villages raided and men, women and children carried off into captivity, loaded onto ships, taken to be sold as slaves in another continent and never seeing their homes again. A familiar enough narrative, except that in this case, the villages being depopulated in this way were English, and the slave traders arrived in ships which had sailed from Africa. Long before the British ever became involved in the slave trade, slavers out of Africa were raiding not only the British Isles, but many other European countries, from Iceland to Malta, Ireland to Spain, and Italy to the Netherlands, carrying off white slaves to be sold in the slave markets of Africa. During the 1970s, the British held hundreds of political prisoners behind barbed wire without charge for years on end. This could have been embarrassing, putting people in mind of South Africa and the Soviet Union, had we not decided to call them internees instead of political prisoners. This solved the problem so well that even to this day, many people don't know anything at all about the political prisoners of the 1970s held in Britain. The same thing with Barbary pirates. The word pirate is faintly comical, bringing to mind Long John Silver, Captain Hook, even Captain Pugwash. Pirates raised the skull and crossbones flag and hunted for treasure, didn't they? The Barbary pirates were actually after people, white Christians specifically, who could be sold as slaves in Muslim countries. Here are some white slaves in Africa during the 17th century. There was a very old tradition of slavery in Africa, long before the coming of Europeans. Black empires enslaved neighbouring nations, various tribes made slaves of outsiders, the Arabs took black people for slaves, and sometimes the other way round. Slavery was an old African tradition, and it is not to be wondered at that it flourished on what became known as the Barbary Coast. Of course, everybody knows about Europeans going to Africa and taking the people off into slavery. It's taught in schools. White slavery is not so well known. The Barbary Coast was named after the Berbers who originally lived there and included countries like Algeria, Tunisia and modern-day Morocco. From ports there, Muslims set off to Europe to seize as many white Christians as they could for the slave markets of North Africa. How extensive was this trade? Was it a trifling affair of a few hundred people here and there? Hardly. The island of Gozo, part of modern Malta, was attacked in July 1551 and the entire population of 5,000 people taken off into slavery. This was a serious problem for Europe, especially the Mediterranean countries, but also for Britain and even Iceland. Current estimates suggest that the number of Europeans captured and taken to Africa numbered in the millions. The Barbary pirates attacked shipping as well as land, and were in the habit of taking the crews of ships and then just leaving the ships drifting on the ocean. In Britain, for instance, the fishing industry was under serious threat in the 17th century because men dared not put to sea in the North Sea or the English Channel for fear of being captured by slavers. On land, some coastal districts of Spain became practically deserted because people feared to live there. From Venice in the north to Malaga in the south, whole swathes of the European coast became deserted because those living there were always at the risk of slavers descending on their villages and taking them off to Africa. The sack of Baltimore in Ireland gives one good example of what was going on at that time. The entire population was removed. Cornwall was in particular danger, being at the end of England, as you might say. For example, at Mounts Bay in Cornwall, 60 men, women and children were taken away. In 1626, St. Kevin was repeatedly attacked, and boats out of Loo, Penzance, Mousel and so on were all at risk of being seized by pirates. It was thought at the time that around 60 Barbary men of war ships were prowling the coast of Britain in the 17th century. Sir John Eliot, Vice Admiral of Devon, declared that the seas around England seem to be theirs. We think of Pirate Island as being in the Caribbean, but for a while the Isle of Lundy in the Bristol Channel was held by the Barbary pirates and used as their base. In 1645, another raid by Barbary pirates on the Cornish coast saw 240 men, women and children kidnapped. To keep the slave population stable, around one quarter had to be replaced each year, which for the period from 1580 to 1680 meant around 8,500 new slaves each year, a total of 850,000 in the course of the century. According to one estimate, 7,000 English people were abducted between 1622 to 1644, many of them ship's crews and passengers. But the corsairs also landed on unguarded beaches, often at night, to snatch the unwary. This was a huge business. The Muslim world needed galley slaves, they needed labourers, they needed people to guard harems, all sorts of people, and they preferred to use Christians rather than Muslims for this. The rulers of the countries of North Africa were entitled to an eighth of all the slaves captured, and these were used for public works. Cervantes, author of Don Quixote, was a slave in Africa for several years before being ransomed. This was another motive for the slave trade. If you could seize well-to-do people, they could be ransomed by their families, sold in effect for money. The rise of the British Navy was in part due to the efforts to combat the Barbary pirates' depredations on the shores of Britain. Samuel Pepys mentions this in his diary. He says, "I went to the Fleece Tavern to drink, and there we spent till 4 o'clock telling stories of Algiers and the manner of the life of slaves there. Captain Mutum and Mr. Dawes, who had both been slaves there, did make me fully acquainted with their condition, how they eat nothing but bread and water, how they are beat upon the soles of their feet and bellies at the liberty of their padron, how they are all night called into their master's quarters, and there they lie. The conditions of the white slaves in Africa were sometimes worse than those of the black slaves in the Caribbean and America. Some were routinely castrated to create eunuchs to guard harems. Others were kept as galley slaves, not setting foot ashore for years on end. The ill treatment of these slaves in Africa was a matter of great concern in Europe." How did it come to an end? Well, it's rather unfortunate. The British began to pay tribute to some of the North African countries in order to prevent the Barbary pirates from visiting their country and seizing their ships. It was guyed up under various terms, but effectively the British were paying not to be molested. This all came to an end for American ships with the American Revolution. They no longer enjoyed the protection that the British had. And so several American merchant ships were seized by pirates in the Mediterranean. This led directly to the founding of the American Navy. It was the Americans who finally put a stop to the efforts of the pirates. It was not until 1830, when France occupied the whole of Algeria, though, that the pirate trade finally came to an end. I think it's fair to say that not one person in a thousand is aware of the fact that African slavers were raiding England for years, at least half a century before the English became involved in raiding Africa for their own slaves. This has been described as cultural amnesia. Images such as this one, black African slaves in the Caribbean, are routinely seen in school and during Black History Month. Images such as this, though, showing white slaves in Africa, are all but unknown. Slavery was endorsed by the Bible and Quran, practiced all over the world from ancient times in every continent. It has literally now become a matter, though, of black and white, for all forms of slavery have been forgotten, save that which involves white people enslaving black people. We have over the last few decades in this country been indoctrinated to see slavery as a wicked activity practiced by European colonialists, chiefly against the inhabitants of Africa. This false impression is taught in schools, and we are given annual top-ups every October during Black History Month. The truth is that at least half a century before England became involved in the capture of slaves in Africa, slave traders from Africa were carrying off people from England and taking them away to be slaves. History is always far more complex than the simple linear narrative that we learn at school.
Slavery was big business. Africans sold other Africans to the Europeans.
We can only begin to imagine the sheer horror of the slave trade.
Yeah. How do you think he was captured? Probably through a war. You know, there were African middlemen, and they would fight wars with other Africans to enslave them to sell to the white man. Slavery was a huge business for different African kingdoms. You know the story that we got when we were kids, that your ancestor was out on one Sunday with his girlfriend and some white man jumps out of the bush and throws a net over him? It's not how it happened. Slavery was big business. Africans sold other Africans to the Europeans.
So after he was snatched from Africa, came over on a slave ship, on that long boat ride.
From hell.
Yes.
Discoveries like this make me even more eager to learn about my own African past.
Thank you. that was the late Phil Lynott, also known as the Black Irishman from the group Thin Lizzy. He was Irish. Some people call him the Black Irishman. Anyway, played some clips there. There is a lot of literature written about the topic of slavery, generally speaking. We can take practically any culture, and I mean, they're like over 7,100 languages, living languages, spoken on the planet right now. All of them have a culture connected to them, and all of them have a slavery story connected to them as well. Just like with the English language, there probably is somewhere around 150 dialects of English. You know, and their books or their literature, that, for instance, there's American English, there's British English, and then within just those two languages, or dialects, excuse me, those two dialects, once again, there's 150 dialects of English. So out of that, there's literature that on the same topic, but told from a different point of view. Now, what I find interesting in the clips that we played today is, and there's a bunch of books written on white slavery, and we're talking about, you know, we can look at it from, the Oliver Cromwell point of view coming from England, British English, stories, and actually, to be honest about it, you probably have to go to England and go to a library over there to get a more accurate picture of the way it's interpreted from an English point of view, okay? Because also under Britain, okay, if you go to a library in Ireland, they're going to tell it from their point of view, you know? And then if we go to certain parts of Africa, because we did hear a couple of statements coming from two different people in the clips I played, that Africans introduced slavery to parts of Europe hundreds of years before the Atlantic slave trade. So it'd be interesting to go to those countries in Northern Africa, and read those. Of course, you have to pick up languages now. You would have to learn different languages to really get to the meat of stuff. And they're like, so there are over 7,100 living languages spoken on the planet right now. And if you just listen to the accents of the people, of the, you know, what I, you know, what I played. If you go down to Barbados, you know, most of the white people that you see that are living there, that can trace their families generation to generation back in time, their ancestors, their family, their ancestors were slaves, white slaves. Some were born into slavery in Barbados, and I've been to Barbados three times. And if you trace it far enough, those ancestors go right back across the water, across the pond to Ireland. But anyway, interesting topic, a lot of books written on it. Put it this way, I had a law professor tell me this. He said, no matter how much you read on a topic of law, particularly any subject regarding any aspect of law, he said, you won't even get to know 1% of the information that's available out there. And I'm applying that to slavery, particularly slavery in general, global slavery, as well as even if we try to narrow it down to transatlantic, because you can't really have a full discussion about transatlantic slavery, in my opinion, unless once we got to go back in the time machine, we might have to learn Gaelic, which is a dialect of English. We might have to learn Gaelic, which is spoken in Ireland, and go through their books and see what they have to say about their history when it comes to them being enslaved. That's food for thought. Huge topic. Which you can spend an entire lifetime on. Let's see. All right, now we mentioned, we're going to get in this later, out this week or next week. House Rent Homes, that's our little brand there, so we'll get into that later. Let's see. A couple other clips I want to play here. Hopefully I got it right. Let me see if I got it.
Welcome to Not Guilty on this Tuesday, July 17th, 2018. Today we're talking about Isaac Wright, Jr. You see, Mr. Wright was wrongfully arrested and charged and then convicted of a crime. His sentence was life in prison plus 50 or 60 years. Mr. Wright, while in prison, studied law, fought his own appeal, won his appeal, went back to the courtroom to prove the prosecution was false. It was a conspiracy. In doing so, Mr. Wright got the police officers locked up. There were false witnesses. He got the judge locked up. He got the prosecutor convicted, who spearheaded the whole conspiracy. And the coward prosecutor, before he reported to jail, killed himself. Now, this is an epic story of conquest and redemption. And it is such a good story that 50 Cent picked it up to make a production out of it. You know, I just learned about this story this weekend. In reading it, I mean, it's compelling. But it also stands for the same principles of why I founded this company. We have to fight back against a system that was never built to protect us. This system is built to lock people up, plain and simple. It's profitable to put people in prison now, which I've talked about before. We have to have the resources to fight back, and that's what Credine is all about. So Mr. Wright is now known as Attorney Isaac Wright Jr. And, you know, he did not stop after getting himself out of trouble. He dedicates his life to helping others, and that's commendable. Very, very honorable. So, Mr. Wright, congratulations. Looking forward to the movie. I don't support Hollywood, but I will be going to see that movie. And, ladies and gentlemen, we are here fighting for your freedom. To learn more, visit Credine.com.
All right. Last week, I watched on Hulu. I binge-watched like three or four nights. The television program that ABC produced, they did two seasons of it, titled For Life. It is based on Isaac Wright Jr., of what that guy just said. It's a very good, man, I binge-watched it. I did it over about three or four nights. And I might, matter of fact, dip back into it tonight. And it's true. I mean, he has got a Wikipedia page. This guy was locked up, given a life sentence on plus some years on top of that, on a drug kingpin charge. And it goes through that whole thing of what he had to mean. Like, say, he went to law school while incarcerated. He was in there for like nine and a half years. He made good use of his time. He went to law school within there. He got through law school, graduated law school. That's 3 years right there out of the 9 years, 9.5 years. Then he had to pass the bar. He did pass that. He served as, what do they call it, the way he was in New York State, inmate advisor. and he started taking cases in the courtroom. I mean, he was still locked up in prison with a law degree and everything, but he took on other people's cases. And, you know, he would go to court. He had permission to go to court and represent these people. You know, he had a suit and everything. And he got, like, maybe three people off. And anyway, ABC did an absolutely fantastic job. 50 Cent, absolute. I'm glad you took it up, the production. They only shot two seasons of it, but it gives you before he got arrested, his conviction, his incarceration, and, you know, like I said, he learned the law, went to law school, graduated law school, passed the bar. I mean, if you look, put it this way, you look at what he did, locked up, us that are not locked up, we have absolutely no excuses. This dude is a black man. Had absolutely no excuses. He didn't have any at all. So I highly recommend that on, once again, the TV show is titled For Life, and it's on Hulu.
This is World News Sunday.
A former lawman turned outlaw on the run. A New Jersey prosecutor is seeing justice from the other side of the fence these days. He's been on the lam since last week when he disappeared from his home, leaving behind an electronic ankle bracelet and a suicide note. Now he's the subject of an international manhunt. ABC's Alexander Johnson has that story.
Anything you tell us, Nick?
Reporters wanted to know how Nicholas Bissell went from being one of New Jersey's most feared lawmen to a convicted criminal. For 13 years, Bissell built a reputation as a tough crime fighter, even appearing on television's America's Most Wanted.
He was the top lawman in one of the biggest and most powerful counties in New Jersey.
But some of his colleagues say that wasn't enough. On May 31st, he was convicted on 30 counts, including obstruction of justice, fraud, perjury, and abuse of power. Many of the charges had to do with money, skimming, and tax irregularities at a gas station where he was part owner. Most troubling, Bissell's other cases must now be reviewed, like the case of Isaac Wright, given life for being a drug kingpin. Last month, a judge ordered him retried because Bissell coerced witnesses against him.
7 years ago, I was a voice among a chorus that nobody would listen to.
This week, 2 days before he was to be sentenced, Nicholas Bissell, the man who convicted Wright, cut an electronic ankle bracelet he was ordered to wear and became a fugitive. Because he fled, Bissell's property, including his house and a condo owned by his 76-year-old mother, are now owned by the U.S. government.
Prosecutor Bissell has it within his power to prevent his mother from losing her home. All he has to do is show up and be sentenced.
Next week, Nicholas Bissell is scheduled to show up again on America's Most Wanted, this time as a fugitive. Alexander Johnson, ABC News, New York.
Been under house arrest after he was found guilty of corruption and fraud in May. Today he took the stand on a case that he tried and won back in the early 90s. Bissell convicted Isaac Wright on a number of drug counts. He's been in jail for 7 years. But he says the former prosecutor, a judge and law enforcement officials, tampered with evidence and forced witnesses to lie.
And a man convicted by former Somerset County prosecutor Nicholas Bissell may soon go free. Isaac Wright, who is serving time for dealing drugs, says he was wrongly convicted because Bissell got witnesses to lie on the stand. The judge says he agrees with Wright and will let him go free unless the state can change his mind. Bissell himself is awaiting a jail sentence for fraud and corruption. He says the whole thing is bizarre. Meantime, the judge is also considering suppressing some drug evidence seized from the home of Wright's co-defendant. The judge says it was seized without a warrant and that Bissell's colleagues never reported it.
A man who spent 7 years in jail on drug charges will get a new trial. A judge in Somerset County threw out all 18 of Isaac Wright's convictions, claiming Wright never received a fair trial. News 12 New Jersey's Adam Freed is in our newsroom with the latest on Isaac Wright and the apparent miscarriage of justice that put him behind bars. Adam?
You know, Lee, Isaac Wright may have been a drug dealer, as prosecutors and police claimed,
But one thing is certain, he wasn't dealt a fair trial. A judge said today that the man who prosecuted Wright made illegal deals with defense attorneys, and now Isaac Wright will have one more chance to plead his case before a jury.
What?
The news was good, but not good enough for Isaac Wright's mother and friends.
They don't have enough evidence to go back to a retrial. And basically, should just release him today and let this man get on with his life.
Isaac Wright has appealed his case again and again. Now, the court agreed he did not get a fair trial. The judge referred to the behavior of the prosecutor as a distinct pattern of disinformation. The judge threw out this conviction for two reasons, because he said police had seized some of the key evidence illegally, and because the prosecutor had made secret and illegal deals with one of the defense attorneys. This was the testimony that opened Pandora's box, a co-defendant who testified against Wright.
Basically, he didn't want to go to jail. So he told me what to say in order not go to jail.
She didn't. Isaac Wright got a life sentence. What turned this case was that the prosecutor, Nicholas Bissell, knew the witness was lying under oath during the original trial. The judge today called that an offensive deception of the judge and jurors. The original prosecutor, Bissell, is already on his way to jail, convicted of a variety of crimes. Now the new prosecutor will have to decide if the pursuit of justice means filing more charges against the man she has just replaced. The prosecutor says that she is going to retry Isaac Wright on all 18 counts of the original indictment. His bail was set today at $500,000, and the new trial is scheduled to begin in January. Lee?
Adam, was that particular prosecutor making other mistakes and other secret deals and other trials?
A lot of people are wondering that. It is certainly possible. There were a number of people in the courtroom today who had been convicted and served jail time from trials that Nicholas Bissell was the prosecutor in, and they were saying that because Isaac Wright got a new trial, they may appeal the decisions that were rendered against them as well.
Thank you to Adam Freed for that report from our newsroom.
A man put behind bars by former prosecutor Nicholas Bissell is free. Isaac Wright has been in jail for more than 7 years. He was convicted on a number of drug charges, including one that accused him of being a drug kingpin. For years, he claimed he didn't get a fair trial. In October, he convinced a judge, and today he was released on $250,000 bail. News 12 New Jersey's Cynthia Scott tells us that Wright may be a free man, but he's not quite out of the water yet.
Isaac Wright was supposed to spend the rest of his life behind bars, but he left the Somerset County Jail taking with him all the work that helped get him out. Wright calls this day bittersweet.
Bitter because it's 7 years coming, and sweet because it's the first step at liberty.
Former Somerset County Prosecutor Nicholas Bissell, who killed himself to avoid jail time, was responsible for sending Wright to jail. Supporters of Wright, who helped post his bail, say Bissell wanted to be the first prosecutor in the state to convict someone under the drug kingpin statute. They say he broke the law to get his conviction.
There were a lot of problems with the case, basically just corruption in the prosecutor's office, which now is being investigated.
Wright convinced the judge of that after years of preparation and weeks of testimony from people who said they were forced to lie. In October, his charges were reversed and Wright was granted a new trial.
He was overwhelmed with so many things that he knew that it was something, the new trial was something that had to happen in the interest of justice. It had to happen.
But Wright may not be a free man forever. His trial that was scheduled on January 2nd was postponed until the state conducts its own investigation. Now, prosecutors say they will retry him, but some say they can't see how.
I can't wait to see their trial. I think that they're looking for a soft place to land. I don't think there really will be a retrial. And if there is, I don't think there's any possibility of a conviction.
I'm confident that, you know, in a subsequent trial that I'll be acquitted.
As for his own civil trial against the county, Wright wouldn't reveal his plans, but he says he wishes this day was the final chapter. In Somerset County, Cynthia Scott, News 12, New Jersey.
Isaac Wright wouldn't tell us where he'll be living, but he says he will remain here in New Jersey.
All right, once again, I highly recommend checking out the Hulu TV show, which is based on this man's Isaac Wright Jr. He's got a Wikipedia page on him, too. But check out, the TV show on Hulu, For Life. For Life, how he got arrested, went to law school while incarcerated. It's... ABC did an absolutely wonderful job in presenting this, and it's matter of fact, I would say, particularly black folk, particularly black males, at the bare minimum, take a what do you call it, a paralegal course. But he went from inmate to paralegal to inmate advisor to law school student to law school graduate, all while incarcerated, to getting other inmates off. Now, he got other inmates off before he got off on his case. But every person that he helped, it helped him prepare for what, I mean, you heard the clip itself. The prosecutor ended up killing themselves. Okay. So, and there are other cases like that. Freeway Rick Ross, hope we can get him in here one day. Because he was illiterate. He learned how to read. When he went to prison, he didn't know how to read. This Freeway Rick Ross out of Southern California. He learned how to read. Matter of fact, we'll get Warren Houston on here soon for that. He learned how to read when he after he got incarcerated, he also had a life sentence. Now, he didn't go to law school or nothing like that, but he learned how to read. Then he started to read, you know, law books and all this other type of stuff. And he got proficient enough where he got his case turned around, and he's a free man today, too. So two interesting people, but for life, I highly recommend it. Like I said, I've been to watch that thing like last week. I'm going in for probably another dose of it tonight. On that note,